Have you checked out projectresurrection.blog? I promise it's the website that will stay the website. And I'm putting some work into it, trying to make it so you can find some of the series and have those episodes separated from just the Podbean setup where you kind of have to scroll through everything. The sermons are being set up there. There'll be more stuff. I'm releasing some old interviews from issues, etc., so that you can find those all together. It's also going to be the place where anything that's new is being published. So on that homepage there, it is also the blog. Blog not meaning I'm going to write there, but it's where I'm going to try to put everything that I can that I'm doing. So if you want to follow my teaching, you can do it there. That's projectresurrection.blog. Yeah, you heard me. Projectresurrection.blog. Also, I really do hope you enjoyed the Raw interview last week with Pastor David Peterson. I was able to do 5 during that week. I'm not going to be releasing them all at once. I want to keep Daniel going, but you will get the 2nd next time. That's with seminarian Bill Winter, a former military serviceman, former farmer, father. Really interesting conversation about all manner of things. So look for that episode next week while I'll be in Florida with my family, speaking at the family conference at Grace Lutheran Church in Naples. You can Google them to find more about that if you like. We haven't spent a lot of time on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, mainly because they haven't really shown up much in the text. But these 3 companions, whether they were friends or not, it's hard to say. Probably, and suffering does forge bonds of brotherhood, right? Whether these 3 guys were friends of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they had to have definitely shared his perspective on things, right? So they too are young men living in Jerusalem during the reign of Jehoiakim, abandoned by their king as a tribute to a greater king when Jehoiakim, the king's, attempts to rebel and join with Egypt fail. And he needs some more time. So, well, off goes the gold and off go you guys. Yeah. Say goodbye to mom and dad. They travel with these implements from the temple of God around the long stretch of that Fertile Crescent, down into the pinnacle of civilization at that time, this great golden capital of Chaldea, we today call Babylon. And they were enrolled with this guy Daniel into the house of holy Hogwarts, right? The satrap land of learning to whisper and incant. And the sorting hat puts on new names for them, and their names are all connected to the gods of Babylon, even though their former name had been connected to the God of Israel. Now they're things like Slave of Nebo and Bel, Save the King. And then these names, we don't really know, you know, what they mean. One of them's connected to Venus. One of them's connected to Marduk. You know, Marduk rules. I'm kind of just making that up. But, you know, Marduk is better than your god. And submit to the wiles of Venus. You know, something like that. Something good, right? Like unto Bel, Save the King and Slave of Nebo. So they're given these names. They go through all the 3 years of training and trial in which they dance between first article truth without abandoning their second article, that is saving or revealed knowledge of God, faith. They witness the miracle of their food making them better and stronger than everybody else, even though they're eating less. And this isn't just about vegetables. Remember, we've talked about this. Hey, you can believe it that way. They just had a better diet. But there's an intervention here. There's a fulfillment of Old Covenant promise here. They are trusting that when God says, I will bless you according to these words, when you keep my statutes, they keep the statutes, and they are blessed. And they graduate with honors. They've got enemies, no doubt, from the other people groups who have joined them in their class. They can't have been the favorites because they're standing apart. They're too good, right, for everything else. They're not willing to be part of this all gods are part of the same system. Remember that the Babylonians, you got to think of them a little bit like the Greeks and the Hindus mixed together. So they definitely had a pantheistic view of godhood and gods, and that'll come back in a little bit now in today's story. But they believe all the gods exist. That's not the question of whether they exist. It's how strong are they and what can they do? And the fact that you would think your God so awesome that even though you lost to their God, you're going to keep worshiping your God and not recognize their God or acknowledge that we have our gods. That's just obstinance on your part. That's just rude. What makes your God so much better than all the other ones? Don't all paths lead to heaven? That mentality was definitely already there long ago. Someone comes up with a day, they're like, oh, I'm so clever, I thought this up. No, it's just what humans always think. It's what humans always think. That being said, they get through all of this and still graduate with honors. And they got their regular entry-level magician jobs in whatever school they excelled in, living at the heart of this Chaldean corner of Chaldea. And then you have, you know, days later, weeks later, months later, but in the course of a couple of days, they go from this unknown entry-level positions to being put in charge of massive segments of the entire country, all because their buddy Daniel, God is judging, all because he is willing to stand upon his faith, pray to the Lord for the answer to a terrifying vision in response to the threat to his life and their life simply for being there. And God gives him that word. He gives him that spirit of prophecy to understand what Nebuchadnezzar's dream meant, to preach it to him. And the result is, not only is he elevated to the highest position under the king, or close to it, but they're elevated as well. I mean, what a ride, right? It's quite a ride. Now, we don't know how long after they took on their new positions and jobs, what happens next happens. We don't know how much time it took for Nebuchadnezzar to decide that the dream which he had had of this glorious statue of which he was the golden head is one that is intended for him to demonstrate to all kingdoms that come after him, that no one would forget that he is the golden head by building this massive statue of plated gold, probably, standing it up in the middle of the plain of Dura, right down there in the heart of that land between the Tigris and the Euphrates, so that, you know, all who would follow would look on him and weep, right, for being unable to achieve what he had achieved. Very Ozymandias-like thing of him to do. So he does this. Now, this is his confession, by the way, that he does not believe in the one true God. And this is kind of the whole point. The first half of Daniel is really maybe better titled The Conversion of Nebuchadnezzar. The bringing of the head of the world power to faith in the God who is greater than all world powers makes them rise and fall. And perhaps that is why he is golden, right? The difference between the gold, the silver, the bronze, and so forth in the statue that he sees, is it just that he has authority? I don't know. I mean, we talked about that last time. Go listen to that. But I think it has something to do with his Christianity. And he is not converted by any means yet. He knows there is a powerful God who Daniel serves. And he has begun to recognize that publicly. By the end of what we're going to see happen next, he really knows this God is there, and he really recognizes this God publicly, but he does not believe. He does not believe. That is yet to come. And he definitely shows his lack of believing by taking this vision that he's had about how everything after him is going to collapse and deciding it's about him and building this big statue, and then commanding at its inauguration that all of the administrators and the chiefs and the commanders and the civil guardians and the judges, basically anybody who's anybody in the entire kingdom, at least, I don't want to say like the provinces, right, but the actual kingdom as it sits there, those within reach of the plain of Dura, along with, you got to imagine, this is not, it lists the names of these official positions, but this is like an inauguration, right? So yeah, the officials have to be there, but it's not as though this giant statue of gold is not going to draw a crowd. I mean, if you think that the inauguration of the President of the United States is a big deal, well, that's kind of how this would have been. Bigger than the State of the Union, that's for sure. Now, as I'm recording this, just this last weekend, there was the March for Life in Washington, D.C. Happens every year, trying to call to mind for the world, not that we're Christians, wise people, and it's not just Christians, right? People who are aware of natural law, not that we're against the value of womanhood, but that we're for all human life, and that a baby is a human life. That march had 600,000 people. In the same weekend, there is a vote in the socialist dictatorship, well, I don't know what it is, of Venezuela, right? There's a vote, and the guy who's in theory just elected to be in charge, lost. The opposition party won. But see, he doesn't want to leave, and there's all this hubbub about that, and you know, Trump says this, and Nancy Pelosi says that, and all this, but the video of the people in the streets coming out to reject the current guy and say, no, we want this next guy, is mind-boggling. I mean, you got a city with the streets just packed. You couldn't even, I wouldn't even know how to move through those streets. Well, so just take those images or any image of a huge crowd. I guess if you want to get lame about it, you can do the dropping of the ball in New York City on New Year's Eve, right? And just so many people there. That's what's going on here. Everybody's there. And I don't know how much warning Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had. Like, you know, I can only imagine it. You're sitting there in your corner office, which you just got put into recently, and you're trying to figure out how to do this new job. You got a clay tablet in your hand, and it's, you know, finding the mistakes in the accounting. We need to do an audit. I can't believe who ran this place before I got here. This is we'll fix it. And you'll knock, knock, knock. Messenger from the king. Everybody in the office building needs to vacate now. Down to the Plana Dura. We got a special inauguration. If you don't come, we're going to kill you. So, and not just in any old way. Like, if you don't come and bow down, you're going to be killed by being thrown into the fire. Furnace. So, everybody come down now. You'll hear the music. You bow down. Good deal, right? Okay, we'll see you down there. You're like, well, I guess I'll sit down my cup of coffee and think about this for a second. Let me see here. Go commit pluralism. Deny my God publicly or get burned to death. And so, you know, you stand up and you follow the crowd because you're looking for your buddies now, right? And there's Meshach. Hey, Meshach. Yeah, what are we going to do here? You know, this is a little rough. There's Abednego over there. Yeah, we can't do this, right? Like, we have to find a way out of this, right? And in the meantime, don't miss this either. Like, whether they're right there with them or whether they're up with the king in some way, they have these other enemies. And these enemies now can't only include the young Chaldean sorcerers who went through training with them and were not as wise or as good or as competent as them, but also includes those who used to be the bosses, right? So it's not like he didn't kill the bosses. Their lives got saved. Now they're just now under these guys. Those guys can't like you much at all, right? Nothing worse than being skipped over for a promotion. What kind of vengeance that'll bring. So as they're going, you got to wonder if they're not being watched pretty carefully already by their enemies. They have to have been. They have to have been. And you know that because of the way that the story unfolds. In the children's books versions of this, you kind of have this, you know, image of the king is sitting somewhere where he can see Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He can see them. And so when the whole crowd bows down, they're right there in front of him. But that's not how this turns out. It has to be reported to him. And this brings up another question that there really is no answer to. So it's not like I'm really excited to share this question with you, but it's a fair question and we just have to acknowledge it. Like, where on earth is Daniel? Where on earth is Daniel? Why is he not in this story at all, right? Was he right by the king? So the king just didn't see him because he was standing behind him? Well, the king didn't see these other guys either. It's reported to them by their enemies. So if Daniel was there, it had to have been noticed. Now, there are basically two ways the scholars have looked at this, and one is full of tomfoolery, and the other one is fine, but I don't know. There's a third one, I suppose, too. So the tomfoolery one is that, well, Daniel just bowed down. I mean, because none of this is really real history anyway. So whoever Daniel really was at that point, he didn't think much of it. These guys did, and now there's a mythology about them. So Daniel was just there by the king. He bowed down. No problem. Well, yeah, okay. If you take that position, you're not a Christian. And it's not a one-to-one, but it sort of is. So indirectly, you're basically confessing you don't believe anything the scriptures say. So we can't go that way. Then you have the idea that Daniel just didn't come. So, you know, in the hubbub of the crowds all going down there, you know, Shadrach sets down his coffee, finds Mishael, you know, they're kind of talking their way through it. Next thing you know, they're in the middle of the plane and the music's playing. And what do we do? Well, we're going to stand here. But Daniel somehow like saw this coming and just never left his office and nobody knew. Right. Okay. Unlikely. Because of the official nature of this with a police force, like compelling it to happen, unlikely that he managed to avoid that, but it's possible. Another option, I think this is the one I like, but Kyle and Dalich do not like this option. They didn't give a real good reason. They just said it was impossible, is that he was away. So, you know, he's made into a chief of the provinces, and he's over multiple provinces. He needs his buddies. Like, hey, okay, so I need some aides here, and I'm going to put them here. They control this area. But, man, we got to go make some rounds and check this thing out and see what's going on. So he's, like, off on a business trip far enough away that he's not included in this thing. I think that's my favorite, although, again, there is no proof for any of this. But it's an interesting thing, right? The book is the book of Daniel. There are miracles that involve the salvation of Daniel multiple times, and yet he's not in this little story at all. And that's because, well, what is this first half of the book about? It's about the conversion of Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel is only a player in that, right? So that's why he's not here in terms of storytelling, but why he's not here in terms of historically, we don't have that answer. So they find themselves then in this massive crowd. You know, more than you could see, so much so that if everyone bowed down, you wouldn't even notice unless you were standing near them, right, that they weren't. You wouldn't be able to look out from the king's position and see who is and who is not willing to bow down. It's just too wide, too far. I don't know. I think, again, about maybe like I've seen images of some of these concerts that famous American bands will do in like India or Nepal, right? And you just have the sea of humanity out there watching them. So something like that, only maybe bigger. And it is intended to be a concert, right? This is an inauguration, but it's also a musical festival. And that part of the text is a little odd, right? So the proclamation reads like this. This is Daniel chapter 3, verse 4. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and tongues, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the burning, fiery furnace. Have a nice day and Merry Christmas." Well, it doesn't quite say that. But you know, it's odd, though, right? This list, and our English makes it sound kind of cheesy, weird, right? So horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe. There were no Scots back there. Well, see, this shows how little English is able to handle some of these things. I think it probably would have been better to keep these in the original tongue. That's just my opinion. You know, I don't always like when we do that. We've done that with things like baptism as a word, and I think it gets in the way sometimes. But in this case, it's not helpful to have these things connected to images that we just can't conceive of. So, well, there's two ways to look at this. I'll give you a couple of the names. We're not going to go into too much detail. But the real thing is what this symbolizes, or what this means in the bigger picture. So you have this thing called the Karana, which we translate as horn. It's a far-sounding horn, right? It's a tube of some sort that would be able to bellow a brass-like sound for a great distance. But, you know, Kyle and Dalich call it a tuba. So don't think trumpet. That's not quite right. And then you have this, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, mesroketa, which literally it means the thing that hisses, right? Or perhaps the slide whistle. But it probably was referring to a flute that was made out of a reed, right? So a very well-carved but cheaply made flute. Now, the Septuagint calls this thing the surigix, which is actually that flute that you know from watching Pan or the fauns kind of play that little pipe flute made out of reeds and they kind of dance around, right? So possibly that. You have the kitharis, which is translated as harp. But see, there's actually two types of harp. There's the kitharis, and then there is the sithara. And this all has to do with where the sounding board is with regards to the strings, right? Is it on top? Is it on bottom? You can find examples of both of these in ancient art. And then there's this Greek name, the symphonia. You can even hear symphony in that, right? But this is the bagpipes. But it's not the bagpipes like from Scotland. It's closer to something that in Italy in the last century they would have called a sampogna. There's two pipes placed in a bag. I honestly don't know what that is. So I Googled it, and you can find something of it. You got to spell it right. Zampogne or N-A at the end. And it does look a little bit like a Scottish bagpipe. There's also a drawing of one that just has a single pipe coming out of it. That's probably more likely the ancient one, right? So it didn't have multiple exit points. It had one exit point and one entry point, but you'd blow into the air into the bag and then squeeze the bag in order to make noise. Okay, oh, sure, fine. That's kind of interesting and all. You got the issue, though, here that the liberal scholars like to grab onto, which is that a number of these things are Greek. And so remember that the liberal wants to believe, this historical critic, the one who doesn't believe this is a real book from Daniel's time, wants to believe it was written during the intertestamental period when Antiochus Epiphanes IV was the tyrant of Judea. And they'll point to something like this and say, see, it's got Greek words, and that couldn't have been known in the Babylonian time because they were stupid and never went anywhere and never came into contact with Macedonians and Athens and all this stuff, which is kind of nonsense. It misses the immense trade atmosphere of the Mediterranean world during this time. So it would be very normal, in fact, for a king who is having a celebration to demonstrate the power of his kingdom over all other kingdoms and to thank his God for having been greater than all other gods, to take all those who he had conquered in any place, anywhere, and had brought all of their cultures to his city in order to teach them to be like him, but also absorb knowledge from them. It would be very normal for him to take instruments from all those regions of the world and pull them together into the greatest pluralistic showcase of musical fanfare regarding the greatest deity that ever was, who's made him the greatest king there ever was. Now, there's a couple of things going on here that we don't want to miss. Who's this greatest deity? This is not Yahweh, the Lord God. He's talking about Bel. I'm talking about Bel, his God at this point, right? He might acknowledge that the Israelite God is a real God, but he still conquered them. And that means his God's still bigger and better-er. Right. Yeah. I know Daniel said the guy controls time. That's great. But Bel's real, too, at least in his mind. And so this whole thing is very much about an acknowledgement of his God. And yet at the same time, it is an acknowledgement of his own kingship. And this is what's going to be key to understanding why he acts the way he does. It's not like he's this malicious tyrant. I know we have trouble thinking of kings as being anything but, and I'm sure he had his moments. But it's not like he just wants to kill people. What he wants is for people to acknowledge that he is king. And this is a way that he's set it up, right? I mean, it's not unlike, we talked about, you know, large crowds gathering. It's not unlike the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, no offense, Colin Kaepernick, you can go ahead and be angry if you want. But like the idea behind the Pledge of Allegiance isn't to say that every American who ever was always did good at all times or that everything in our history is always perfect. It is to say that there is an idea at play behind our constituted government, which is for the good of mankind, in theory, right? Republic for freedom. And that we submit to that idea, that we seek equality with all people. This is the crazy thing. I'm really on a tangent here, but the crazy thing about refusing to kneel for the Pledge of Allegiance in the name of equality is that the whole point of the Pledge of Allegiance is that we're devoted to equality even though we've made mistakes in the past. Like, the idea is that we're going to keep getting better at this, not worse, right? So strangely, the one who won't kneel is actually saying, I don't believe in equality, which if you follow the conversation, it's true that the far, what do I call it, progressive edge of the race debate doesn't believe in equality at all. They're actually more racist than anybody else, but that's a whole other thing. Just see then here, in Nebuchadnezzar's mind, this is like the Pledge of Allegiance. And yeah, one nation under God, which God? For us, well, we don't really say which God, and so it's a little more okay. for him, it was like under the particular god who is the chief at this point of all the gods, and this idea of the gods, we'll come back to that. This isn't that big a deal for him. It's just normal, run-of-the-mill way that the ancient world handled gods. They're all kind of real, and sometimes they're stronger, and sometimes they're weaker, and right now this one's stronger, and it's why I'm king. And so if you reject this, you actually are rejecting my kingship, and you are a threat to the kingdom. And that's the threat here. Yeah. So he to show this off, though, too, right? So to show this off, he has all this music to get people to acknowledge he's the ruler of all these different nations. Now, I don't know quite how to imagine this. This would not have been an orchestra. This would not have been like we're really prepared with this four-part movement with different or four-part symphony with different movements that are all kind of together, and all these musicians really know how to make each other make all their pieces work together. It would have been, I mean, to our ears, I don't think there's any way to argue against this. It would have been noise. It would have been blowing on things hard, right? You ever seen a kid like try to just blow on an instrument that, you know, blow through a trumpet or a clarinet or whatever? You know, they might have been good at it, but it still would have just been blowing hard on the noise, right? And then you're taking a bunch of different ones and just shoving them all together and saying, you know, all of you do it now, right? It reminds me of, I heard a story once. This was on my vicarage. Don't tell a lot of vicarage stories anymore. But I heard a story once about a family who had visited one of these big, awesome, growing, you know, church growth / Pentecostal congregations. And in the middle of the worship event, call it church if you want, in the middle of the worship event, the worship leader, who was a lady, had gotten this idea that, you know, diversity is so awesome that we'll just stop playing and I'll shout, sing whatever song comes to your mind right now. And all the band will be ready to do this, or we'll have prepared each a different, we won't talk to each other. We each have a different song. You just start doing it. And then everyone else will do it too. And it'll be this amazing glory moment from God. And these Lutherans are sitting there visiting and they're like, holy moly, it was chaos. It was just disgustingly odd, like just noise. Everything was in conflict and discord, which is what happens when you don't plan your music, right? Well, the ancient world, while they may have had some level of musical planning, it certainly wasn't progressed to what we would call music today. It would have been noise. And the point was, when you hear all this noise that you can't miss, when it gets so loud, everyone's got to acknowledge the kingship of Nebuchadnezzar. And the way you acknowledge that is by bowing down to this image of his god Bel, right? Or him as the image of the god Bel. So now here's Azariah, Mishael, and Hananiah out in this huge, massive crowd. They've been pressed together. They can see kind of off across the plain here, this huge statue. They've heard the proclamation, and there's the noise. And everyone around them is suddenly kneeling down, and they're just stuck looking at each other. You know, one of them shrugs. Here we go. Yeah. And you know, that it happens, and everyone gets up. That's cool. He's inaugurated. All right, let's go back to work. Right? They all go back to work. Like that, it passed without too much of an issue. But see, Malfoy was, you know, right there. Right? And if you don't know who Malfoy is, then you probably should read Harry Potter or at least watch the first movie. I'd prefer you read them. I'm not a fan of the movies. But, you know, he's the guy who was the equivalent of Harry at the school for the wizards, who was his enemy and was a real jerk and hated him and did everything he could to harm him, right? So who was there when Azariah didn't kneel down, but whoever his enemy was in some way, or at least a friend of the enemy, right? Or maybe the boss who he's to plant. It doesn't matter who, but you get the idea, right? Malfoy is there. And he sees that they're not bowing down. He's got to be just smirking ear to ear because he's wanted this, right? He's wanted this opportunity. Oh, they got him now. Look at these arrogant punks with their one true God talk. What's that all about? They're going to get it now. So somehow, quickly, but it doesn't necessarily mean that moment, the word gets back to the king. It's brought before the king. Now, when I say it's not that moment, I mean, I'm saying that because this was this huge inauguration event, right? And it's not like they could have run directly up to the king at that moment. They would have been shot. But quickly, probably within the day, the king's sitting there sipping his 15-year scotch. I don't know what they make or drank back then. It was coffee. I don't know. But he's kicking back in the evening. It was a good day. Inauguration went well. That statue will stand to the end of time. And, you know, his advisors, who also have it in for the Jews. And this is a theme, right, in the intertestamental period, in the exile period. Just think of the book of Esther. People don't like these people who have benefits because their God is for them. So, you know, his advisors come in. We got a guy you got to listen to. He says there's these three guys, and they're in charge of a bunch of stuff, and they're these Jewish guys, right? And so, you just got to hear they didn't bow down today. Now, the way the text gives us this is really kind of interesting. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have not been mentioned yet. We've got the whole proclamation. We've got all the music. And verse 7 just tells us, therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sounds of horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, all that stuff, right? Every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, languages fell down and worshiped the golden image. Now, I can't help. I'm sorry. This is a stupid hobby horse, but I just got to say it, right? If you just take that text literally, that means Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did bow down. All the peoples, it says. All of them. It says it right there. The Bible says it. Read the text. Why am I mad about that? Because this past year, I was accused of heresy by someone locally because I refused to say that every Pharisee didn't believe in Jesus before he was killed. Just because there's places where it says all the Pharisees were against him. So, yeah, they were. But that doesn't mean every single one. Just like right here, all the peoples, right? It's a broad term. It's so common in the Bible. It's common in language. We do this. We have hyperbole or a part for the whole or the whole group represented by one individual. Anyhow, it does not tell us in this, if you're going to be that kind of wooden literalist, and I don't think that means you respect Scripture. I think it means you disrespect Scripture. Well, then it doesn't mention Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But verse 8 tells us, therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans, right, these are those who are part of the schools, those who are of the wizarding class, came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. Interesting here, too, it still doesn't mention anybody by name, right? It just says the Jews, and there's more than a few of them. It's not the full exile group yet, probably, but it's more than a few. Now, it is going to say in a few verses that this is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but again, part for the whole here. These are the guys who actually did it, but notice the picture being bigger than just them, right? The phrase that we translate, you know, come forward and maliciously accuse them, I really like the literal read on this. It says in the Aramaic that they came forward to eat their flesh, right? Which it doesn't mean they're actually cannibalistic. This is an ancient colloquialism. We actually have a very similar one today. Like someone gets really mad and they want vengeance. They want their pound of flesh. Same kind of idea. It doesn't mean you're actually going to go cut the guy's leg, right, and rip out pieces of muscle. But they want to devour their flesh. They want to take from them what they most prize. They're after it by a maleficent means and way. So they go in and they declare to the king, "Oh king, live forever." Right? Oh, listen to that. That's Belteshazzar, right? May the God who is Bel protect and save the king. Now it isn't really Belteshazzar, Daniel's name, but it kind of is, right? That's how they call him. "Oh king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that all shall do this thing with the image, yada yada, yada yada. But there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up." Notice the "you." They are playing to the king's ego. They are playing to the king's paranoia. They are playing to his pride and his hunger for the power which he does have to be recognized by others. They are intentionally painting this in the worst possible way so as to infuriate and enrage him. And that's, in fact, exactly what takes place. In a furious rage, he commands that these guys are brought before him. And it's worth noting here that while he's in a furious rage, he also is a fairly reserved and controlled king. He doesn't say, well, then throw them all into the fiery service. He actually holds a trial. He says, bring them here. We will put them on trial. And when he does that, when he brings them before them, he actually gives them a chance to both prove themselves to have not done it and or to actually just go ahead and do it right now. So there's he's mad, but he wants to really know. And the question that he asks here, you know, is it true that you do not serve my gods? Again, here the original language has a little more of an edge to it. So it's like he's searching for something. It's not just, did you not do it? You know, where were you on the night of the 5th of December? You know, it's not just like that. There's a little bit of a why, right? Would you do this to me? You who I have elevated to this level of power? Do you scorn me? Like you can see his hurt in the language here a little bit. No, he's confused. Why? Why would you not simply acknowledge my God as well? I've acknowledged your God. Why won't you acknowledge my God? After all, I'm here in charge of you, am I not? Why would you do this out of scorn? Look, I'm so reasonable now that if you're ready, if you can show me, prove to me this wasn't out of scorn. It may have been indeed ignorance on your part, right? Just tell me that's what it was. Here, look, we'll get in the musical instruments. We'll have them all play it right now. Horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, every kind of music. And you can fall down and worship the image right now. And everything's going to be well and good because this has to be just a misunderstanding. I'm mad, but really, I don't want to be. But I will be. Because if you do not acknowledge my kingship by worshiping, you shall immediately be cast into the forge. And who is the God that shall deliver you out of my hands? And there's a lot there in that. And the forge, normally, what do we call it? The fiery furnace? Sounds kind of cheesy. It isn't hot in the furnace, man. I think that's how it went. I had to sing that in grade school. You know, we mock it almost, right? We make fun of it. So trying to envision this furnace, this forge, it's no easy task, honestly. We'll come back to that. There's a better place to do that. But I want to just kind of put it out there right now that I cannot conceive of a realistic way to picture this, no matter what I do. I mean, I can conceive of a really boring way that is just boring and is a big pillar, a big fiery thing. But it should sound better than fiery furnace. Fiery furnace sounds like a clay oven, some sort of weird, or it used to make me think of, I remember in my house in Portland growing up as a kid and having heard this story, the furnace was like this big old contraption down there, right? Made of metal, but no human could fit inside of that. And you certainly wouldn't throw people in from the top. So what is this furnace? Let's come back to that. Whatever it is, it's a threat. And in that threat, he confesses that he does not believe in the one true God, because while he believes in the gods, most surely, and believes that they are powerful, they can give visions and do stuff like that and help him fight and defeat his enemies, like, really, once I've put you in fire, like, let's just build a big fire and I'll just tie you down into the fire, like, really, there are no gods who can stop that. They would have to strike me dead before it happened. And we all know that that's not going to happen because I've got this vision that I'm going to be the greatest king there ever was. So, right, what are you going to do about it, guys? There is no God that can do this kind of thing. Gods don't do this. They don't save you from this kind of thing. Now, he is not blaspheming Yahweh at this point. He doesn't know Yahweh. He doesn't know who the true God is. That's the point. He is ignorant. Now, the response that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have to this is really quite profound. I mean, it's noticeable that they don't call him king. They just say to him, O Nebuchadnezzar. And this isn't necessarily an insult, but it is sort of a, like, well, yeah, not quite kind of thing, right? O Nebuchadnezzar, we know who you are. We have no intention of questioning who you are. But, you know, we don't even really need to answer you, honestly. Like, if you think that we're not for you, you're foolish. Our God teaches us to serve in the nation in which we have been set, according to the prophet Jeremiah. We heard him preaching it before you brought us here. We're going to do everything we can for you. But here's the thing. Like, if you think that you're going to harm us in such a way that our God cannot save us, you are gravely mistaken. Now, this doesn't mean that they were believing that they would not burn in the furnace. This is so important. They were not believing that they were going to have a miraculous encounter with God at this moment. Now, had they had a miracle, I've made the case that the vegetable eating power of diet that they got, that was a miracle. But it was a miracle based on something very specific. It was based upon the promises given to them in the Old Covenant to follow the laws that God had prescribed, and he would see them through things. And all of that, if you don't know this, you need to know this. All of that is not about being saved from my enemies right now. The ultimate hope of the Old Covenant, just like the New, is the resurrection of the body from the grave. This is why Abraham was willing to sacrifice Isaac. This is why Joseph had his body taken out of Egypt back to the Promised Land, so that when the resurrection occurred, he would rise with all of his family and be there with them, right? This is the hope that David confessed when he said, "You will not abandon my body, my soul, to Sheol, or let your Holy One see corruption." They believe in the resurrection of the dead. And so they stand there before this king who is saying, "I'm going to burn your bodies in the fire, and what God is there to stop me from doing this to you?" And they're basically like, "Well, you're right. We got nothing to say. You go ahead and do that to us if you want, but you got to know, no matter what happens, it's not actually going to do anything to us." And this is no audacious expectation of some mystical moment miracle, which is actually what's going to happen. But they're not expecting that. This is a faithful resignation. This is them praying the Lord's Prayer. "Thy will be done." Kyle and Dale, let's say it this way. The three simply see that their standpoint and that of the king are altogether different. Also, that their standpoint can never be clearly understood by Nebuchadnezzar, and therefore, they give up any attempt to justify themselves. But that which was demanded of them, they could not do, because it would have been altogether contrary to their faith and their conscience. Without fanaticism, they calmly decline to answer and only say, "Let him do according to his own will." Thus, without superstitiousness, committing themselves to the deliverance of their God. Now, that doesn't mean that Nebuchadnezzar liked it, right? They simply stand firm and say, "Look, king, you're going to do what you're going to do. We can't really do something against our God." And with this, his face changes toward them. That's the way the language reads. His face changes. His rage and fury are so much there that, like, you've seen this, right? Where the guy's, he's grimacing and his face turns red and there's like a vein, like, pulsing on maybe both sides. It's like he's going to pop. He is so enraged. He has been fully reasonable with them. He has demanded nothing of them he would not demand of himself. He is giving them full liberty to continue worshiping their God, and they are simply refusing to acknowledge his reign by means of his God. This is insane on their part. They are obstinate. They are a useless, mindless troubler. That's it. Nothing more. And so he announces, right? "Multiply the forge to 7 times its full heat." Now, that would have been a lot. Again, now we're back on this forge thing, right? How do we imagine this thing? That it could be amplified to 7 times its heat. What was it for? Like, I don't think, I've never seen this, maybe someone can prove me wrong, but I'm pretty sure that ancient kings didn't just keep fiery furnaces lying around so they could have one for stuff. And this wasn't like the normal means of punishing people. It would have been very expensive, even for a king, to keep some sort of like permanently heated thing for throwing humans into. I mean, maybe. I've not seen any research to say that they have. This is a unique thing. What was it for? What? And here's the thing. It's not like it's that tough. Now, this is full-on speculation. The Bible doesn't tell me so. But it's not like it's that tough. What had just happened in the last couple of weeks? Oh, had they just built a giant statue made of molten metal? Oh, yeah, they had. Oh, wait. So maybe there was this huge, like, industrial-level forge, one of a kind, built for the sole and glorious purpose of creating the greatest statue there ever was to commemorate the greatest king there ever will be under the great God that made it so. This is why, again, rather than fiery furnace, you got to hear it as a forge. And if you want, I don't know how to imagine this in ancient world imagery, but I can do it if I think of dwarves. Yeah? We'll go back in the Tolkien world a little bit here. You think of the Lonely Mountain in those movies recently, that all those massive forges. Or if you're into any kind of fantasy world, you know, the dwarves and their smithies under the Iron Hills, pounding away, melting everything in this grand heat. And you've seen images of forges dealing with steel, right? This boiling molten level that kind of, boiling molten metal that can be like poured and laying out into huge beams and bars. Now, how does that actually apply? I don't know. But that's how I'm going to think about it, right? So there's this tremendous one-of-a-kind forge made of some kind of stone so that it can be heated beyond anything that had ever been done so that they could do this massive amount of metalwork all at one time. And with that, so over the top of it somehow would have been a way to put the thing in which you melted the metal, right? So inside, lots of coal, right? Just, I don't know what they were using to generate the heat. But over the top is a hole where you could then melt the iron works. It wouldn't have been iron, but you know what I'm talking about. And then you have to have, though, near the bottom, a way to get the fuel into the forge. So there's a way to get close enough to throw the stuff in, right? So to heat it to 7 times the normal heat, how do they measure that? I don't know. But if you can imagine like a steampunk world, right, steampunk dwarves, there's a meter there on the side and you're watching it go up, you know, past ridiculous speed to ludicrous speed, right? It's so hot then that when the military men, the soldiers who grab Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and take their fine silken clothing, including their hats and the special shoes, the language there is people debate a little bit, but basically they were wearing the three classic parts of Babylonian garb. They wrap them in their own clothing. They use their clothing like a straitjacket and wrap them up in it so that they're bound and tied and they cannot move, which is going to mean they're going to burn all that much faster in a sense because the clothing is definitely flammable. Right. And then they're tied up in it. So they can't run out or anything like that. These soldiers, these mighty men with their military armor. If you want to imagine them as dwarves right now, why not? Right. Big beards or something. They probably did have big beards. They lift these guys over their shoulders and they see that the forge has been heated to the right amount. And they go up on this scaffolding that's been built temporarily, right, for melting the metals. And they get close enough to throw them in. And actually, as they're right about to throw them in, the heat that's rushing up out of the top of this thing is so intense that it actually burns their faces and their arms. They collapse and they fall down dead, dropping these three guys into the even greater heat. I mean, they got to be dead already, right? So down on the ground, but far enough away that he's not near the heat, the king and his advisors are looking into the hole through which the fuel would normally be put, but no one can get any more fuel in there. It's too hot. They see the collapse of their men above. They see the bodies drop down. They land on the fire, and he's watching. And, you know, maybe there's like a scattering of ash and sparks fly a little bit. And there's a moment, and then he can't quite tell what he sees. Like it looks really weird. But there's three things that seem wrong about the picture Nebuchadnezzar sees as he stares into the heart of this glowing forge. One is that he threw in these guys who were tied up, like completely tied up and bound up in their own clothes, like they're in bags, right? And now he sees guys that are not tied up. They're walking, which they shouldn't have been able to do. They're walking around, gesturing with their hands, seems to be maybe even having a conversation, which brings us to the second thing. They're not hurt. They really should be. Those other guys died. They didn't even go in. These guys are in. They're now free, and they're not dead. That's weird. And wait, didn't we throw in three? Why are there four? And why is this fourth one glowing? Right? Now, I don't know if he was glowing, but what he says is, you know, didn't we throw in three? Why do I see four? And the fourth is like one born of the race of the gods themselves, right? What does that mean? I don't know. I imagine this molten being, right, that he is actually, the forge is darker than he is. He's brighter than that, and he carries with it the heat, but he's the same size as the other guys, and he's sitting there walking with them, and they definitely are just having a conversation unbound in the midst of the burning, raging heat. Now, this shocks the king so much that he stands up. Now, this is the counterpoint to his face changing. Right before, his face got all crazy with rage and the vein in his temple was going to pop. Well, now he stands up and he's got a different image on his face. Now his eyes are wide. His mouth is dropped. He's taking in a breath. His face is going white with shock and fear. He cannot believe his own eyes, so that he actually, like, he literally does think he's going insane, which will happen to him, by the way. He literally does think he's going insane. He's like, wait, guys, they were bound, right? 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 They're bound? Yeah. Okay. So they're bound. They look like they're not hurt, right? Like this. Where's this fourth one come from? And everyone affirms, yep, you're right. You're right. This is pretty weird. And he then does something a little bit ludicrous itself. Like this is the fire that's killing people. And he runs up toward it. He gets close enough that he can call in. Now, had the heat decreased by this point, how far away was he? You know, you can imagine he's putting his hands up to kind of shield his face from the heat coming off this thing, even though he's 50 feet away from it still, or 40 feet away from it. But he calls out. And a couple of things here with the calling out. He calls out to three, not four. He does not say, hey, you of the race of the gods with your molten glowing skin, come out here. He doesn't say that. You stay in there. You're good. I don't need you. Right? He calls out just to the three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I can't help. It's not right. This is not like a one-to-one typology, but I can't help but think of that day when Jesus stood outside the tomb of Lazarus and called out, hey, come out here. And immediately Lazarus comes out. They're in their own grave, and the king is calling to them, come out here. And these three persons, they come out. And I want to jump straight to the stunning nature of their exodus here, but let's not skip too fast past this fourth person. Well, who is this guy? Yeah? The text never tells us. Later, the king will call him an angel of the gods, which doesn't mean angel of the Lord, but we should probably see the connection there so far as the Hebrew mind is concerned, that this is the angel of the Lord. But the king doesn't know that. Maybe he's not. Maybe he's just Michael. Maybe he's just a servant of the Lord. But really, I don't know how you can not think this is Jesus, right? I'm not saying Jesus of human flesh, born of Mary. He had, well, I guess he could, like, through a time hole, go back from his ascension to do this directly. Why not? Sure. But however you want to look at that, this is the eternal Son of God, the God who is the face of God to us. Right? The Father no one has seen, but the Son is always making the Father known, and here he is doing what they were convinced he would do, just in a different way. They were convinced that if they die, they're going to be resurrected from the dead, and he's like, yep, going to do it right now. Right now, I'm going to stand here with my molten lava skin, and I'm going to give you the most marvelous thing. You're going to not exist in reality as you know it for just a little while. You're just going to stand here, and I will shield you with the presence of my glory. My glory and my heat and my light will be so great that this seven times magnified furnace actually doesn't exist so far as your skin and your clothing is concerned. So that when they come out, and this is, again, you know, this is the forge of impossibility. When they come out, not only is their clothing not even singed, not only is their skin not burned at all, their hair is just like it was, maybe a little muffled up from being tasseled with the hat and everything being pulled over their heads, but they don't even smell. Like, I like me a good, you know, backdoor fire, right? Like a fire pit, get a little whiskey, get a cigar, do some barbecue. I like a good barbecue. Barbecue and fire pit go together. But what I don't really like so much is how my clothing tends to smell afterwards. Like if I'm in a barbecue with charcoal, at least, then, you know, I'm not going to wear that t-shirt out later that night. I'm going to change clothes because it stinks. You just can't avoid it. Just by being close, I'm not even like in the fire, right? I'm just in the proximity. You know, you've had this happen. Well, these guys, they were in the fire. And they don't smell at all. You can't, there's not a whiff on them. So Nebuchadnezzar is standing there, like covering his face because it's too hot. They're just walking out. They maybe walk away with him. Hey, it's okay, King. Let's get over here where you can look at us, right? And he's like, they don't even smell. What is this? And he just begins to praise in a limited way. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel. What does that mean? Sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies. Right, to resurrection, yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Now, the thing about the angel language here is that angels aren't really a part of ancient Near Eastern mythology. There are varying kinds of gods, different levels of beings. If you want to put it kind of through the Greek spin, dryads and lesser gods and other spirits, right? Different stuff. But the idea of the angel as we conceive of it really wasn't part of the way they thought about it. So it's weird, right? Probably a translation issue that the Aramaic is using, and we don't want to read too much into Nebuchadnezzar's understanding of it. So that in his mind, he is basically saying that your God, this wasn't your God in the furnace. He is a messenger of the gods. He is one who was sent by your God to save you. But your actual God wouldn't do. No, you see, he still is in this mindset. What God can save you from my hand? No God actually comes down in a body. Not like that. Not for you or me or anybody. Nothing like that. There's no incarnation, right? So just see it more as in that direction. And as I mentioned, by the way, not an angel like we would think of. Just recognize that we don't think of angels right today either. Most of our art and images that deal with angels has nothing to do with the biblical angels. Sometimes they do look like humans, but usually not like the pretty ones that we... I mean, they have to say fear not when they show up for a reason. Isaiah, we've done this here on the show, right? Isaiah and Ezekiel, the cherubim with their glowing fire faces and animal faces, right? I mean, they're scary. They're scary. So this is how this guy was scary. This was molten Superman down in the fire, right? Your God is blessed for having sent this angel to you because you disobeyed me. And this is a pretty marvelous moment here. Because he, remember his pride, he still thinks pretty highly of himself, but he recognizes at this point that their God is greater than he is. Now, this is not his conversion. And the key to this is back in verse 26. When he says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out here. I think there might be an inclination for an American Protestant to think Most High God is a way of confessing the true God, but it's not. He didn't say servants of the true God, which is the language Daniel used, right? I worship the true God. He just says Most High God, and that means there's more. He still believes in the pantheon. He still believes in the pluralistic, everyone should kind of recognize the gods that everyone else has. But I will admit now that I was wrong in thinking your God's not on the top. So your God, the Most High God, Bel, my God, number two. They're buddies probably, right? Something like that. Kyle and Dalich say it this way. The marvelous deliverance of the three from the flames of the furnace produced such an impression upon Nebuchadnezzar that he changed his earlier and humbler judgment in verse 15. What God is there like this that can rescue you? He changed his earlier and humbler judgment regarding the God of the Jews and spoke now in praise of the might of this God. He not only openly announced that this God had saved, verse 28, but also by an edict issued to all the peoples of his kingdom, he forbade on pain of death the doing of any dishonor to the God of the Jews. Nebuchadnezzar, however, did not turn to the true God. He neither acknowledged Jehovah as the only or the alone true God, nor did he command him to be worshipped. He only declared him to be a God who is able to save his servants as no other God could, and merely forbade the despising and reviling of this God. There ends the quote. But there is this kind of Esther-leaning moment here in this. Remember how it was the accusation was brought against the Jews earlier, even though it was just these three guys? The result of this is a proclamation. Verse 29, I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb. They were nice back then. Torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Now, while that is kind of a rough ancient world kind of justice, notice this. Up to this point, it was possible for these foreign Hebrews, these Jews, to be having charges brought against them because of their God, because of their holding to the truth of their God. And now the king has made a decree in the opposite direction. They're allowed to believe in their God. They're finally given really the freedom to worship as God dictates to them. And if someone were to try to be prejudiced against them or accuse them, they now have legal recourse in Babylon to defend themselves, which is kind of a key thing here, right? So in and underneath this, the world power has had the word of God inserted into it, and the word of God is beginning to bubble up to the top and benefit everybody, frankly. Even though that's not what it's for, it's not here for temporal benefits, but that's what's beginning to happen. Finally, what we don't want to miss is how this fits in the bigger picture of the narrative of Daniel, which is not merely the conversion of Nebuchadnezzar, that's sort of the front end, but it is also the story of the powers of the world being demonstrated to be incompetent when compared to the power of the one true God to enact over history a salvation for the people whom he chooses for himself. Kylan Delitzsch say it like this. If we attentively consider the import of this narrative in the bearing on the history of the kingdom of God, we learn how the true worshipers of the Lord under the dominion of the world power could and would come into difficulties, imperiling life, between the demands of the lords of this world and the duties they owe God. But we also learn that if in these circumstances they remain faithful to their God, they will in a wonderful manner be protected by him. He will reveal his omnipotence so gloriously that even the heathen world rulers will be constrained to recognize their God and give glory to him alone. Now, this should not teach us to become fanatics who believe that in every possible danger to our temporal well-being, God is going to enact by sending his angel in molten form to remove us from the furnaces of our life. But it is to confess, thy will be done, O God. Whatever you do to me now, whatever king or country rises up to threaten me with whatever punishment, be it to be cast into molten fire, be it to be torn limb from limb and scattered to the winds, lined up and shot, throat slit, sawn in two, though they take our life, goods, fame, child, wife, though these all be gone, the battle still is won. Because the omnipotence of God doing the impossible, being greater than the forge of impossibility, this is demonstrated once and for all. Not in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego coming out of the fiery furnace, but in Jesus of Nazareth, head held high, not smelling like death, walking out of his own tomb. So that on that great day of his return, when the archangel will blow the trumpet, a music that will not merely be noise, but the finest sound that's ever been heard in all the history of the world, that on that day, you're going to walk out without a hair on your head harmed.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? Project Resurrection is made possible by listeners like you and your patronage of my husband's work. Click the Patreon link in the show notes to sign up. Pretty please?